You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although Marlon Brando worked very hard throughout much of his life in the spotlight to remain as private as possible, he left behind hours of audio recordings where he revealed his darkest insecurities and his most private thoughts. He talks about fame, the craft of acting, and his eventual hatred of both of them. The tapes, which were discovered recently, are the basis for a new documentary called Listen to Me, Marlon, which premiered at the Sundance to rave reviews and opens today at the Showtime a Showtime documentary, which opens at the Film Forum on West Houston Street today. I'll get it right. Joining us now are the film's director, Stephen Riley, and Marlon Brando's daughter, Rebecca Brando. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
This film is not a typical celebrity documentary. It's composed almost entirely from archival audio of Marlon's private recordings, and it contains a 3D hologram of his talking head. Were they made by him with the future in mind?
Well, the hologram that you mentioned, that was, in fact, reconstructed for the film from a three-dimensional 3D scan that was done of Marlon's head several years before he died. That was something he was just personally interested in. And in fact, on one of those audio tapes, he talks about having that scan done because he had this prediction into the future, and he was very ahead of his time in many respects, including this, where he thought that actors will, in the future, be replicated within computers and digitized.
You won't have to use a real actor. You could just use the digital hologram of them.
Pretty much, yeah, and Marlon gives that performance that he predicted within the documentary.
Some of the things he's talking about seem to be involved in self-hypnosis, but he talks about a lot of different stuff. What are some of the things he talked about?
In the tapes, mm-hmm. He talked a lot about self-hypnosis. He talked about his acting and ways and special techniques that he used, how he would go onto the set and how he would research. And for instance, in the movie, he says, you know, you got to get them on your time and you got to get them when they least expect it and have them, you know, stop the popcorn before it drops in their mouth. So I thought, you know, in many ways, I think it's a really good film for especially the actor to kind of get some notes on acting.
Did he talk about these things over the dinner table when you were growing up?
You know, that's a good question that a lot of people have asked me is, did he talk about his acting? And the answer is no. It was almost taboo. In fact, it was taboo. The only time that I would learn about my father as an actor was through friends or friends' parents and the outside of the house. So we only talked about, you know, just the daily things in life.
And you didn't go to the movies? You didn't see any of the movies?
No, he didn't have us come to any premieres or see any movies. The only time that my dad had ever asked me, involved me with his filmmaking is the last movie, or one of the last movies he made was The Score, and he wanted me to work on the set with him or on the production with him, but I was pregnant at the time, so I didn't go. Another time was when I remember sitting in the living room, and he was sitting with his assistant, and they were discussing as to whether he or not they should do Don Juan DeMarco, and I was sitting with him, and he said, "Do you know this boy named Johnny Depp?" And I said, "What? Johnny Depp? Of course I know Johnny Depp." He's like, "Well, I'm thinking about doing a movie with him." And I said, "Well, you better do a movie with him, Dad, please." And so he ended up doing Don Juan DeMarco. And I say to everyone who asks me what films are my favorite, and that's one of them. Because he portrays himself in that movie very much like a father figure. And
Stephen, how did you find these tapes?
Well, the tapes, it was a lovely coincidence because the documentary was first being proposed. It had been 10 years since Marlon's passing, and it felt right to commemorate a film or do a film on him. But there was no creative brief at all. There was just access because in the course of that access, I was inquiring, so, what might we possibly be able to use in the film, and And what was the, oh, so, yeah,
well, you were approached. Somebody said, "We have these tapes."
Oh no, it was it was less around that. I mean, the pitch, there had to be a pitch to the estate, which involved the creative approach, and then in the course of that, the archive became available, and I should mention that the archive had been in storage for 10 years, and the coincidence was that this was all just being unpacked at the same time the documentary was being talked about. So yeah, and it included in the end, when all the boxes were opened, about 300 hours of audio tape.
Obviously, you had to do a lot of sifting through and editing. Your previous films are about the underground music scene, sports, James Bond. How did you get involved in this? Did you enter it knowing a lot about Marlon Brando's life?
No, it's sort of strange. Sort of the these films and how I've ended up, you know, coming to do them. I wasn't an expert on Bond, but I soon learnt a lot out of necessity. And same for Brando. I mean, I was actually less a fan of the Bond films than I was of Brando's movies. I mean, I grew up watching The Godfather and Apocalypse Now, and knew Marlon, you know, as the screen icon within my favourite films. But I had to research him from scratch.
Well, the film also covers the way his attitudes toward acting changed over the years. And we have a clip in which he talks about his early years as an actor.
We developed the technique of acting very, very early. Even from the time we're a kid, where we're throwing our oatmeal on the floor just to get attention from our mothers. Acting is surviving.
He says everyone has a secret, something that they're hiding. And then he says acting is surviving. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, I think what Stephen has portrayed on this film is very key to my dad's basically technique to survival, and he chose a career which came so naturally to him, in that he was becoming people that he wanted, I guess, because his mother was unable to give him the attention he needed throughout his childhood. He was always performing for her to get any sort of attention, and so by doing that and mimicking him and becoming other people other than himself just to be accepted, it came naturally to him, and so he put it into his career and drew out so much emotion from all that he had deep buried inside that he was able to use that in his acting.
In fact, let's listen to another clip, this one in which he's talking about his parents and how that created a trigger mechanism for showing contempt on screen.
If I have a scene to play and I have to be angry, there must be within you trigger mechanisms that are spring-loaded, that are filled with contempt about something. I remember my father hitting my mother. I was 14.
Now, you get the sense that he was deeply affected by his relationship with his father. And, Stephen, you've included footage of both of them with Edward R. Murrow on the TV show Person to Person. What happened during that interview?
Well, it was very revealing in terms of showing the dynamic between Marlon and his father. Ed Murrow asks his dad what ought to be the obvious question, like a rhetorical question, like you must be a proud father right now, in the aftermath of Marlon having won the Oscar for On the Waterfront, and you hear Marlon's dad saying, well, no, I'm not as proud of him as an actor. And this was it. And I think it was amazing, revealing of the inferiority that his father had instilled in him from an early age.
Didn't he say he thought about his father when he was in A Streetcar Named Desire, when he was being bullying?
Well, that was it. And that was part, you know, I'm convinced the reason, probably the main reason why Marlon gave up his theatre acting, because he gave himself so much. I mean, by using the method meant that he was accessing all these emotions from his early childhood, which included the dysfunctionality of his household and the violence and the aggression of his father, which he was channeling into the character of Stanley Kowalski. So it was no accident that he found it too much after 2 years of doing this on Broadway. The last thing he wanted to do was go back on stage.
Rebecca, you were with him during the late years, a time when most people felt his career had gone into decline. And Manola Dargis says in her review of the film in today's New York Times that the criticism was the revenge of the mediocre on genius. But Was he bothered by that criticism?
By that time, he was already to the point where he didn't listen to any of the press or what anybody said. He just went and did it his way. And I think in the film it shows where he kind of, there was an archway or arc where he just decided to do the films the way he wanted.
He says he wanted to be involved in motion pictures to change it into something honest. And he expresses disdain for some pretty beloved actors like Clark Gable and Humphrey Bogart.
Well, I think the disdain you might be talking about is how they were, it was a very predictable acting. I think that their delivery and their performance was always the same, where he brought it out, he changed acting and it became more raw and from an authentic place.
I remember when, many years ago, when I saw The Young Lions, and my response was, all the other actors in it were perfectly fine, but they looked like they were acting. And there was Marlon Brando playing this German soldier looking just like he was a real German soldier. It was acting on another level. But there were a lot of people who were using the method at that time, the Stanislavski method. Was he just better at it than many of them?
You know, it's so funny because everyone mentions the method, and I don't know if my dad thinks that he was using the method. I think he was basically kind of turned it into his style. I know Carl Malden said one time, he said Brando didn't use the method acting. It was Brando's way, Brando's style.
Well, he studied with Stella Adler, who did come out of Stanislavski, but it was different than Lee Strasberg's approach at the Actors Studio.
Right, and he resents being affiliated or associated with Lee Strasberg and I think there's rumor that Lee Strasberg had taught him, but the only mentors he talked about were Stella Adler, of course, and Elia Kazan. Those were his true teachers.
He says Mutiny on the Bounty was perhaps his worst experience making a picture. He said, I never want to do that kind of movie again. What was so horrible about that shoot?
I think he just had to deal with the big Hollywood machine. There was a lot riding on it. Of course, famously, the film went very much over budget, much like Cleopatra in the same year. They nearly brought down the entire studio system. And Brando felt that he was made the scapegoat for all those troubles. He was difficult on that film. The film took a direction which he never expected. He wanted to be consulted on the script. It was in his contract, and he had really ambitious. He had his own ambitions where he thought the script ought to go, but he had issues with authority, which was then right back to his dad. So he was tough on that. But
who was the director?
Originally it was. The director we had issues with was Lewis Marsden.
A pretty great director from Hollywood's past. And he wound up directing himself. He directed One-Eyed Jack. So how did he deal with the authority issues when he's directing his own movie? Maybe. Do either of you have a sense of that?
Well, no. I mean, it's a great film, by the way. Even though Brando didn't approve of the final edit, the edit was taken away from him. It still remains, many people's favorite Western, among mine, and Martin Scorsese's favorite for sure.
But Quentin Tarantino's favorite as well.
I didn't know that. But he was, he was meticulous. It was a long shoot. It went over. He was quite a perfectionist. Again, it showed how dedicated he was to his craft. He cared, I think, whether he was directing or acting.
Now, the film also covers all the troubles in the later years. Well, first of all, he quits acting and then he goes back. He has a kind of revival after The Godfather. People were saying he was finished and now suddenly he's hot again. But then there were all the other issues, kidnapping, killing, suicide. You were living through all of that?
Yes, I was. I was living through all of that. And, it's hard. There are some clips in the movie that show the tragedy that happened to my sister and brother. And, to everyone, it's a story. But, when you're watching it and it's your experience, a whole different dimension.
Was it painful watching this film at times?
I was just telling Stephen before we came in, I had gone through a long grieving process, and this film kind of broke the shell of grief that I was surrounded with, and it came out with an emotion, and I had seen it when I saw it. I walked out of the theater, and I just couldn't take it, because it you have your father in surround sound, and he's there right up there on the big screen. So of course you're going to have a lot of emotion and mixed emotions. And then, you know, I had to take myself out of the place where I put myself in the public eye. And the next time I saw it, and really, because I had a sense that it was a good film, and I didn't know why yet. But then when I saw it the next night and the next night after that, it really hit me that it was really done well.
Some of the things that he said, I suspect, were a surprise to you, even though he was your father and you talked about a lot of those things.
Mm-hmm. You know what? Like I said, we were not encouraged to get into the film business. We didn't talk about it. He did not talk about it at all in the home. And so I did learn a lot of things. I was really surprised that he had all these wonderful insights as to what he did as an actor and how he prepared for each role. I mean, he would really study the history of the time the movie was taking place, and he studied the culture. He'd really get to know the playwright. So he did a lot of preparation. Like Stephen said, he was a perfectionist.
And I'd imagine for you, Stephen, this film had to be to some degree a labor of love, because it involves so much editing, not just of all the audio tapes, to create a sense of an autobiography, Marlon Brando telling his life story, but also finding all of those images that had matched what he was talking about, and then the archival things, the interviews, despite his desire for privacy, he had a very unprivate life for many years.
It was tricky. The edit was very technical. It was dealing with lots of different audio sources, and had to be very grouped and categorized thematically, just to get. You can imagine once all the tapes were eventually transcribed, and that it was. It was in folders that came off the floor several feet high, and so that was even just breaking that down with a highlighter pen and putting notes in the margin, then bringing it into the edit. It took a long, long time. But the biggest hurdle to surmount was that it was entirely in the voice of someone who was deceased, and I didn't know any examples of that had been done in another documentary, which was exciting in terms of trying to do something original, but also really worrying about are we going to pull this off?
How would you say the title? I've been trying to figure out how to say "Listen to Me, Marlon." Listen to me, Marlon.
Listen to me, Marlon. Well, actually, do you know that? So the title comes from the self-hypnosis tapes, and which
he's telling himself to listen to himself.
Yeah, and he would, and this is it. So he's addressing himself, so it's Marlon talking to himself rather than someone telling Marlon to listen.
Thank you both so much for being on our show, Stephen Riley, the filmmaker responsible for this new documentary, Listen to Me, Marlon, and also Rebecca Brando. It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you both.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you.